Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, August 27, 2013, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group teleform conference call. On today's call, we're going to be discussing the decision in In re Aiken decided recently in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. This is the case that concerns the proposed nuclear waste site on Yucca Mountain, but also has implications much greater than that. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. As well, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We have a lone expert today, a repeat offender, returning guest, Mr. Adam White. He is counsel at Boyd & Gray & Associates here in Washington, D.C. He writes prolifically on legal and policy issues, and his writings appear in the Weekly Standard, the Wall Street Journal, National Affairs, and the New Atlantis, where he serves as a contributing editor. He's also a member of our leadership, the Executive Committee of the Administrative Law Practice Group of the Federalist Society, and we're very pleased to welcome him back today. He's going to give us some background and then talk about the opinions in this case with opening remarks of about 12 to 15 to 20 minutes or so, after which we're going to turn to you for your questions. So please be ready with your questions at the conclusion of his opening remarks. With that, Adam White, please go right ahead.
Thanks, Dean. Let me just begin, before I get into the case, my old job, I was an associate at a firm before this job. I used to be in an energy practice, and it just happened that my energy practice involved a lot of preemption and constitutional issues and other things, and I used to say when I was speaking about it that I had the most interesting job in energy law, and then I had to sort of add the caveat that probably sounds like damning by faint praise. In talking about the Yucca case here today, I find myself in the same situation. Nuclear regulation is not exactly the most politically charged, and it's not often seen as the most intellectually interesting area of law, at least in terms of constitutional law, but it just happens that in the D.C. Circuit, there's been a series of litigation and decisions that have given rise to some of the most interesting separation of powers and constitutional discussions the court's seen in years. And so I'm here to describe the most recent decision, which came out earlier this month, in a case called In re Aiken County. I'll give the backdrop to that, the background of that litigation with a slight summary of nuclear policy, and then move on to the regulation. Now, we've had a civil nuclear program in the United States since the end of World War II, and for almost that long, we've been grappling with what to do with all of our spent nuclear fuel and high-level nuclear waste. The policy question has occupied Congresses and presidents and regulators and now the courts, and this new decision from the D.C. Circuit, really the third in a series of three decisions, illustrates the difficulty of resolving these issues, including some serious separation of powers questions regarding the powers of each branch vis-a-vis the others, and the allocation of regulatory power between executive agencies and independent agencies. Now, my remarks on this call are going to draw largely from a long article I did last year for the New Atlantis, which is a policy quarterly that focuses on technology and policy and society and culture. It's published by the Ethics and Public Policy Center, the think tank headed by Ed Whalen, and the journal is edited by Adam Kuiper. And I'm also going to draw from a blog post I did last week for the Weekly Standard on Yucca Mountain and this new case. Also last week, the Weekly Standard had a longer piece of mine on the D.C. Circuit's role in law, policy, and regulation. And all those articles are linked on the Federalist Society's page for this teleforum. And let me add that the cases I'm going to discuss are linked in the blog post I did about Yucca Mountain for the Weekly Standard. Now, before I get to the cases, let me begin with a brief overview of the policy issue, Yucca Mountain. And I'll start with a quote from the president. It's a block quote, so bear with me for just a moment. One of the best potential sources of new electrical energy supplies in the coming decades is nuclear power. The president continues, but nuclear power has been entangled in a morass of regulations that do not enhance safety, but that do cause extensive licensing delays and economic uncertainty. Government has also failed in meeting its responsibility to work with industry to develop an acceptable system for commercial waste disposal, which has further hampered nuclear power development. Now, that's a quote from the president, but it's not President Obama. It's not even President George W. Bush. It's President Reagan in 1981, not long after he took office. The problems he was complaining of at the time are the same problems that confront the nation today. In fact, the problem of what to do with spent nuclear fuel and high-level nuclear waste goes back even decades earlier. In the 1960s, the Atomic Energy Commission began to look at a plan to store nuclear waste in Kansas, but Kansas didn't want what some called, quote, the somewhat debatable honor of becoming an atomic garbage dump. In 1982, after Reagan stirred up administrative energy on the issue, Congress passed the Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982, which created a multi-step process to create two national spent nuclear fuel repositories by 1999. In the 80s, the Department of Energy started studying sites in five states, Mississippi, Nevada, Texas, Utah, and Washington. And in 1986, the Energy Secretary, Harrington, recommended three sites, Yucca Mountain, Nevada, Deaf Smith County, Texas, and Hanford Engineer Works in Washington. Obviously, those three sites then began to compete not to be selected as a site. But within a year, Congress bypassed all of that by ending the Energy Department's process and selecting the Yucca Mountain site as the only repository site. And at the time, the chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, Louisiana Senator Bennett, said, quote, I think it's fair to say we've solved the nuclear waste problem with this legislation. Now, other senators had other things to say, in particular Senator Harry Reid, who went on to say that the 1987 amendments were, quote, the screw Nevada bill. Now, the 1987 amendments picked the site for the repository, but it did not pick the actual technical specifications of the project. That would come from a proposal to be made by the Department of Energy and approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. In 2002, the Energy Department finally recommended a project to the President. President Bush approved it. In 2008, that DOE recommendation became an application that was formally applied. It was the subject of a formal application to the NRC. Then under the statute, within a few years, the NRC would approve or disapprove the project, and if approved, then the project could finally go forward to construction. But as the DOE was filing its application at the NRC in 07 and 08, something else was happening across the country, namely the onset of the presidential primary process. And in 2007 and 2008, one of the most important Democratic primaries, early primaries, was Nevada's. And so Senator Clinton and Senator Obama largely campaigned in Nevada on who could oppose Yucca Mountain the loudest. Senator Obama had an op-ed in a Nevada newspaper where he said, quote, I want every Nevadan to know that I've always opposed using Yucca Mountain as a nuclear waste repository. And he said, I believe all spending on Yucca Mountain should be redirected to other uses. And later, he responded even further during the primary, responded even more loudly, saying, you've got the Clinton campaign out there saying, quote, he's for Yucca. What part of I'm for Yucca do you not understand? Now, once he was elected president and sworn into office, he made two very important appointments. He appointed Stephen Chu to head the Energy Department, and he promoted NRC Commissioner Gregory Jaxo, a former Reid protege, to be chairman of the NRC. And those two agencies then quickly set into process the president's goal of ending the Yucca Mountain application. By the end of 2009, the Energy Department had developed its policy to end all spending on the Yucca project. In 2010, it filed an extraordinary motion at the NRC's licensing board. It asked the NRC to dismiss the DOE's own application, quote, with prejudice. In other words, the Energy Department wanted not only to withdraw its own application for Yucca Mountain, the one filed the year earlier by the preceding administration, but the DOE, by including the terms with prejudice, wanted to prevent all future Energy Departments from ever reapplying for Yucca Mountain. Now, the licensing board at the NRC denied that application for reasons I'll get to in a second, and that was appealed to the full NRC. And at the NRC, Chairman Jaxo delayed a vote for as long as possible using a variety of bureaucratic tools that I describe in my new Atlantis article, and which were described in a report by the NRC's Inspector General. Meanwhile, while the vote was delayed at the full NRC, he used his budget authority as chairman of the NRC to unilaterally direct NRC staff to basically mothball the project. And in the end, after a lot of wrangling, the NRC in 2012 finally split 2-2 on whether to proceed with Yucca Mountain, and the deadlocked commission ordered the NRC staff to wind down the project. Now, with that out of the way, let me get to the litigation. Now, the reason why the DOE's decision to withdraw, or its attempt to withdraw its application, and the NRC's own actions, the reason why they're so controversial, and the reason why the NRC's licensing board denied DOE's motion to dismiss, is that the Nuclear Waste Policy Act requires the DOE to file this application, and it requires the NRC to issue a decision within 3 or maybe 4 years of receiving this application from the DOE. In other words, this federal statute required the NRC to make a decision by 2012. Now, in 2010, when the DOE made public its decision not to proceed with Yucca Mountain with its motion to withdraw, a group of affected parties, including the states of Washington and South Carolina, filed a mandamus suit in the D.C. Circuit trying to force the DOE to go forward with its application. And that gave rise to the first in this series of three decisions. The first case is called In Re Aiken County. It was decided in July 2011. The panel of judges was then Chief Judge Sentell, Judge Brown, and Judge Kavanaugh. The D.C. Circuit unanimously dismissed the case for lack of ripeness. And the court held that since the NRC had not yet issued a decision on the Energy Department's motion to withdraw or to dismiss the application, the court would stay its own hand while the NRC decided what to do, because the NRC's decision might dispositively resolve the issues. Again, that was Judges Sentell, Brown, and Kavanaugh. In addition to Judge Sentell's opinion for the court, Judge Brown had a very short concurrence in which she stressed that the NRC was a very relevant party, and the NRC had arguably abdicated its own responsibilities under the statute, but the parties hadn't sued the NRC. And so Judge Brown stressed that by focusing exclusively on, quote, the president and the administration, the petitioners, quote, may snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, even if they won in a mandamus suit against the Energy Department. And Judge Kavanaugh had a very long concurrence stressing the theory of the unitary executive and the president's control over the administrative state. Kavanaugh wrote, quote, this case is a mess because the executive agency, the Department of Energy, and the independent agency, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, have overlapping responsibilities. Now, let me make a brief aside. As I wrote my New Atlantis piece, I thought Judge Kavanaugh's discussion of the unitary executive was a little puzzling. While it's true as a formal matter, the independent NRC and the executive branch Energy Department had split jurisdiction over this, I didn't think there's really any question that the president had, in fact, gotten his way with respect to nuclear policy. I think it was pretty obvious the president did get his way, and the problem was not the split of jurisdiction, but rather the problem was that both agencies were violating statutory mandates. Now, the court's decision in that case in the 2011 expressly noted that things might be a little different with respect to ripeness once the NRC's 2012 deadline for a decision passed. And when that decision did pass, or that deadline did pass without a decision from the NRC, it gave rise to the second case, also named In Re Aiken County. In 2012, largely the same parties filed a mandamus suit against the NRC, not the Energy Department, asking the court to force the NRC to go forward with its Yucca Mountain review and issue a decision. Now, this was a new panel of judges. Judge Kavanaugh was on from the previous panel, but instead of Sentell and Brown, we now had Judge Garland, now Chief Judge Garland, and Judge Randolph. And I've got to say, this was a very weird case. Again, this time they sued the NRC instead of the DOE, and at oral argument, the judges were asking the government for the DOE position, but the DOE wasn't there. So the Energy Department received an order from the court requesting supplemental briefing. The DOE, like the NRC, just argued that there wasn't enough money to complete the Yucca Mountain process, and therefore the court shouldn't force the regulators to do anything. And so that gave rise to the second decision, also titled In Re Aiken County, in August 2012. I call it a decision, but it's more of a non-decision, because the court issued a short order holding the case in indefinite abeyance and ordering the parties to update the court going forward on the status of appropriations for fiscal year 2013 in order to see what Congress might do in terms of funding the Yucca Mountain process. Now, Judge Kavanaugh had a concurrence, and he said, quote, it behooves us to wait for Congress to, quote, make clear its intent on the matter Judge Randolph dissented. He said, quote, Congress has its responsibilities. We in the judiciary have ours. Whether the mandamus should issue when an agency is willfully defying an earlier Congress's command has never depended on the possibility that a later Congress might do something to excuse the violation. Here, the NRC has disregarded a clear statutory mandate citing a lack of funding, when in fact it has sufficient funds to move forward. The fact remains that Congress has already spoken. We should not wait for further instructions. Now, in the coming months, the parties made supplemental filings about the appropriations process, and it made clear that the NRC had about $11 million on hand, enough to proceed with the Yucca Mountain Review, but not enough to finish it. And Congress's fiscal year 2013 appropriations included no new appropriations for Yucca Mountain and no specific instructions on Yucca Mountain. And so that gave rise to this latest decision issued earlier this month and also titled In re Aiken County. The court split 2-1, holding that the NRC had violated the Nuclear Waste Policy Act by failing to issue a timely decision and ordering the NRC to proceed with its review of Yucca Mountain, even if the agency doesn't have enough money right now to complete the entire review. Judge Kavanaugh wrote the opinion for himself and Judge Randolph. Kavanaugh's opinion included a lengthy discussion distinguishing circumstances in which presidents do have power not to enforce statutes. Judge Randolph pointedly declined to join that part of the opinion because it was, quote, unnecessary to decide the case. And in his own opinion, Judge Randolph stressed, quote, Chairman Jaxo of the NRC orchestrated a systematic campaign of noncompliance. And he added, once Congress has decided the order of priorities in a given area, it is for the executive to administer the laws and for courts to enforce them when enforcement is sought. And that was a quote from an old case called TVA versus Hill, which many people remember as the snail darter case. Now, like I said, Judge Kavanaugh wrote for a two-judge majority. Because Chief Judge Garland dissented, he would not have ordered the NRC to proceed with its review. And he said mandamus is, quote, a drastic and extraordinary remedy reserved for really extraordinary causes. And he said that here the court is ordering, quote, a useless thing, because there's no indication that Congress will resume funding for Yucca, and therefore there's no indication that the NRC will ever actually be able to complete the review that the court has ordered. Now, I strongly recommend that you read all three sets of opinions, which are linked in the blog post I did for the Weekly Standard last week. Judges Sentell, Brown, Kavanaugh, Randolph, and Garland all make very interesting points regarding the allocation of power among the branches, including the allocation of power between executive and independent agencies. Now, in this last minute, let me just raise a few points. And I must confess, I'm better at raising these questions than answering them, especially when we're talking about them in terms of the Yucca Mountain litigation, which is really a sui generis case. Now, obviously, the most politically and constitutionally charged point in all of this is the issue of the president or administrators refusing to enforce statutes. You know, Judge Kavanaugh, in particular, has served in all three branches of government, in the White House, in Congress, as a staffer, and in the courts, and he's made clear that he's a proponent of the theory of the unitary executive, namely the president's responsibility and power to control the executive branch and administrative state. And Judge Kavanaugh, in his latest opinion, went out of his way to highlight other cases in which presidential non-enforcement would be justified. First and foremost, there's the issue of when the president has constitutional objections to a statute that's on the books. And second, he wrote at length about how presidents often have prosecutorial discretion not to take enforcement actions against violators of a federal law. And he stressed that neither of those circumstances were relevant here. And I'd note that Judge Kavanaugh made similar points just a few weeks earlier in a case called Center for Biological Diversity versus EPA, which came out in late July or early August, I think. That was a case involving the EPA's decision not to regulate biogenic carbon dioxide. There, the EPA had attempted to justify non-regulation of this form of greenhouse gas based on three administrative law doctrines, the de minimis doctrine, the one step at a time doctrine, and the administrative necessity doctrine. Those are three more doctrines in which regulators' non-enforcement of statutes might be justified in court. Now, on top of all that, there's the separate question of when should courts intervene to resolve these sorts of non-enforcement disputes. Mandamus is an equitable remedy, as both Sentell's opinion for the court in 2011 and Judge Garland's new dissenting opinion explained. And when you're talking about equitable remedies, there are a variety of prudential factors that need to be considered, which, again, Judge Garland erred in his dissent. Now, even with respect to Yucca Mountain, there remain at least three questions that I noted in my blog post. First, what happens if the NRC exhausts its $11 million reserve? What will the parties be able to do, if anything, to force the NRC to go forward? Second, there's the question of what if the Energy Department refuses to do anything further? I mean, now that it has filed its application and its application is on the books, if the DOE simply refuses to go forward with any further process, what will that mean for the parties? And finally, the statute requires the NRC to make a decision. So what happens if the NRC just rules against Yucca Mountain and declines and disapproves the application for safety or on other grounds? The Nuclear Waste Policy Act pretty clearly envisioned that Yucca Mountain would be the site of the process. But what happens if this particular application isn't approved? We start at step one. Where do we go from here? I walk through all these issues in the blog post and in my New Atlantis piece. I think they raise very difficult questions, and I don't have easy answers for them. This is an area, not just Yucca Mountain, but energy infrastructure permitting in general, where vast discretion is vested in regulators, and it remains to be seen what, if anything, the courts can truly do to force issues, or what even Congress can do other than setting deadlines and hoping that administrators approve projects rather than disapprove them. Now, I've already spoken on it at great length, probably too much length, and so, again, I thank Dean for the opportunity to describe the issue and these cases, and I welcome any questions that listeners may have.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Adam. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for our guest, Adam White, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our floor mode. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, Adam White, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our phone lines are open, and while we're waiting to see if we do have questions, let me announce at least part of our upcoming schedule. Tomorrow, we will host a teleforum conference call on the RAINS Act. That will be with a group of panelists reconsidering the RAINS Act. Seems like a perennial piece of legislation on the Hill. It requires that Congress, before a major regulation goes into effect, that Congress have an opportunity to give a thumbs up to that piece of regulation, or I suppose a thumbs down. Once again, today we're talking about the Yucca Mountain case. In Ray Kieran, if you have a question for Adam White, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Adam, forgive me if you covered this in your opening remarks while we're waiting to see if there are questions. Is this headed to the Supreme Court? What's happening procedurally from this point?
Well, it was just decided 2 weeks ago, and so the next steps will be to see whether the administration intends to ask the full court for on-bank review, something which I've not if there's been news on this, I haven't heard it yet, but I was out of the office last week. After that, there's a possibility of a cert petition. I would add that we may well see similar issues in the Supreme Court in the much publicized litigation over the EPA's greenhouse gas regulations. That's a case where the EPA, in regulating greenhouse gases, it substantially increased the thresholds for the regulation of the statutory thresholds for regulation of greenhouse gases or of any pollutants. Normally, the pollutants are regulated if they're at very low ton per year thresholds, and which didn't make sense for greenhouse gases. And so the EPA really increased those limits by orders of magnitude in order to make the project feasible. And so a number of litigants in that case, which cert petitions have been filed and they're pending at the Supreme Court, have argued that the EPA does not have authority to draw back its regulations to that level. And so we'll see in that case what the government or what the court, whether it takes the case, and if so, what it ultimately does. And so that's how it may get up to the court. And let me just say, in the blog post I did for the Weekly Standard, I tried to put this case against the backdrop of the bigger article I did for the Standard about the D.C. Circuit's role in policy. And there's been a lot of debate over the D.C. Circuit's role right now. We're seeing President Obama having already appointed one person to that court. He's now made three more nominations. And the D.C. Circuit has been the target of substantial criticism from the New York Times and blogger or columnist of the Washington Post and others, saying that the D.C. Circuit is a very activist court. And in this new in the article I did last week and in this blog post, I argued that the D.C. Circuit's actually been very, very restrained, and it mostly is thrust into disputes. I thought the In re Aiken County case that really is a good example of how restrained the D.C. Circuit has been. I mean, here we have litigation that's been going on for years, and even last year when the NRC was pretty clearly in violation of its statute, the D.C. Circuit gave basically Congress and the president and the agencies a full year to get things in order and to resolve the dispute without judicial intervention. And only then did the court finally intervene. Judge Randolph would have, if he had his druthers, would have done it a year earlier. But even after a year, Judge Kavanaugh was finally on board. And I think it goes to show how the court really, especially in these types of cases, is very restrained. And I think there's a lot of, I think in that restraint is largely justified. But in any event, I think it really does strike a blow against those who argue that the D.C. Circuit is an activist court reaching out to resolve politically charged hot button issues.
Have other bloggers agreed with you after having read this opinion that this is sort of a restrained response, or are others beating up on the court for this?
This maybe it's because it's in August, but this decision's largely flown under the radar. Jonathan Adler at Volokh.com weighed in with a similar take, and he linked back to a really terrific article he did for the Environmental Law Institute's publication earlier in the year, discussing the D.C. Circuit as a very restrained court and pushing back against critics who argued that the D.C. Circuit was a pack of judicial activists. And I really encourage people to check out Jonathan's blog post and his piece for the ELI. And I think both of those are linked on my own blog post last week.
All right. Once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We do have one caller that indicates he has got a question. Let's see if we can unmute his telephone and go to that first caller.
Good afternoon. Very excellent commentary. Thank you. My question is, given the politics, executive discretion, and bureaucratic inertia that exists, sometimes attributed especially to this administration in waiving or not enforcing various laws, and assuming that Congress is exercising one of its enumerated powers, how could Congress draft a law to be sure that its will would be carried out? How could they do better than what they've done, apparently, in giving an awful lot of reason for argument and foot dragging in this case?
Well, thanks for your question. It's a very difficult question to answer. It's a very difficult issue to resolve. And we're seeing this pop up not just with respect to Yucca Mountain, but with respect to the administration's foot dragging on drilling permit applications onshore and offshore, where legislation has attempted to set deadlines for the administrators to decide. We saw this actually in Yucca Mountain, where Keystone XL pipeline, where Congress fed up with the president's and the State Department's foot dragging a couple of years ago, set a deadline for the president to make a decision on the Keystone pipeline. And interstate oil or international oil pipelines are subject to the president's authority, not an agency's authority. Congress set the firm deadline, and the president complied with it by rejecting the application and starting the whole thing over. Now, to answer your question, how could Congress act within its powers to settle this issue? Honestly, I think the only answer would be Congress would have to prescribe by legislation a set of technical specifications equivalent to the very detailed specifications that regulators and project proponents have to formulate in the regulatory process. Basically, Congress would have to replicate the entire process or the substance of the entire review process itself, and then lay down those requirements in legislation. I say that in theory. I don't think that could ever probably work in practice. There's a reason why Congress has delegated, so to speak, these issues to regulators who can spend a lot of time and have the expertise to formulate it. And it's really one of the fundamental quandaries of regulating energy infrastructure is Congress is not really in a position to formulate the technical specifications of these sorts of things. At best, what they can do is pick sites and locations. After that, there's really no answer other than committing the matter to regulators to make the decision. And so I think then fundamentally it becomes a question of policy and politics. And I don't mean politics in the partisan sense. I just mean these issues, if they're going to be resolved in the face of regulators or administration dragging its feet, it has to be elevated to a national issue, and the public has to decide through elections whether they're going to allow the foot dragging to continue or not.
Once again, if you have a question for Adam White, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Adam, is some kind of appropriations rider ever an option here in terms of the relationship between Congress and the agencies? I always hear about oversight hearings and questions and follow-up questions and holding people's feet to the fire, but when I was in the executive branch of government, the one thing that seemed to really get the attention of the leaders of an agency is when their funding was either threatened to be cut or constrained in any way.
Well, that's one possible option. Congress could condition appropriations on for other important administration projects and policies, condition those appropriations on the timely completion of, say, the Yucca Mountain project. But here in this case, one of the sort of underlying themes is the fact that the case is litigated against the backdrop of an appropriations process that had largely broken down. It was very interesting. Last year, when the court held the case in abeyance and ordered the parties to update them on the status of appropriations, basically the way that the court set up the burden was the burden would be on Congress and the President to lend additional clarity and instruction to where things stood with Yucca Mountain, and in the absence of further instruction, the court would ultimately, as they did this month, issue a decision ordering the agency to go forward. Now, in the appropriations process, Congress was largely silent on the matter. They didn't appropriate any more money. It was just continuing resolutions and so forth. And in the absence of further clarity, the court then said, well, from that we decide that Congress, or from that we ascertain that Congress hasn't changed its mind on the matter, and its mind was set in the 1987 Nuclear Waste Policy Act amendments. So I guess in theory, appropriations might be a way to solve this, but again, the backdrop of this entire case is, in recent years, is an appropriations process that's largely broken down. And I think that the political resolutions that would give rise to a repaired appropriations process are probably the same political resolutions that would give rise to a decision over whether to elect an administration that's going to go forward with Yucca Mountain or not. And by the way, while I'm talking about politics, I probably should add in passing, and I note this in one of my articles, that while President Obama had placed Chairman Jackso, a vocal Yucca opponent, as chairman of the NRC, it was President Bush, actually, that appointed Jackso to the NRC in the first place. And so another issue lurking in the background is the general tradition of appointing officers to the independent commission, such as the NRC, the traditions of bipartisanship, of largely deferring to relevant or important senators, and I think those traditions are all laudable. It does add, though, a complication when someone like Senator Reid is basically able to install at the NRC somebody who's ultimately going to end a project like Yucca Mountain. I'm not saying that those traditions that give rise to that are bad. I think they're good. I do think, though, that one of the collateral consequences is the effect it has on projects like these.
Very good. Well, Adam, it seems that we've exhausted the questions from the audience. We've got a few more minutes here. Let me see if you want to express any final thoughts or give a final statement.
No, well, I guess my final statement, I've said it earlier, is I strongly encourage listeners to read the sets of opinions that came out in 2011, 2012, and 2013. I think they are some of the most interesting discussions of separation of powers and administrative responsibility and discretion that the D.C. Circuit's issued in any cases in recent years. And again, nuclear power is not naturally the most interesting subject matter in general, but it has happened to give rise to some of the most interesting constitutional questions the D.C. Circuit has faced in recent years, and I hope that I can help to draw attention to the court's work.
Well, terrific. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you, Adam White, for joining us today. To our audience, I encourage you to monitor your emails and check our website for our next telephone conference call scheduled for tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time, when we'll be talking about the RAINS Act and oversight of the administrative state by Congress. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.